I am Beth Anderson. I'm with the Superfund Research Program, and I will be the moderator for today's session. We will get started in a few minutes, but while we wait for others to log on, I want to cover a few housekeeping items. So when you registered, you were directed to this seminar-specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have included bio sketches of the presenters. So please note the presenters' email addresses are hot linked on that page in case you have any questions for our presenters after today's presentation. For those of you who are joining us via the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call, and we will have a question and answer period, at which point you will need to take your phone off mute. We ask that phone participants keep their phones on mute during the question and answer session unless you're asking a question. To unmute your phone line for your question, you need to dial *6. You also may need to press your phone's mute button if you previously put yourself on mute. After you ask your question, place your phones back on mute by pressing *6 again or using your phone's mute button. So using this mute feature will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. So by now, those of you participating via the phone lines should have the presentation open and should be on slide 1. The number's in the lower right corner. All of those participating via internet should have clicked on the Go To Session icon near the bottom of the page. And you should also be on slide 1. So, as explained on slide 2, so move to slide 2, the main page contains the slides above which you will find the navigation icon. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question icon you see on the slide, and you do not need to wait until the question answer period to submit a question. And in fact, we encourage you to go ahead and submit your questions in advance so we can prepare. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question icon to alert us to technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include your phone number where you can be reached, and we will try to work with you on troubleshooting the problem. So, I want to point out that the presenter will be announcing the slide numbers on which they are moving to. You may advance to the next slide using the right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number on the left-hand frame. So you're in charge of yourself of moving forward on the slide. At the end of the presentation, we will walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We really do take your comments into consideration as we try to continue to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. And these links will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack. In the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Past web seminars are available on the CLUIN website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for the Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information, or CLUIN archive. And you'll also be able to access our new SRP Research Brief podcast, so check us out. With that, we're ready to start our session. Once more, to phone participants, please keep your phones on mute, and again, do not put us on hold. So, now, at this time, I'd like to turn the session over to the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, Dr. Linda Birnbaum, who will give you introductions for today's web seminars. Linda?
Thank you, Beth, and welcome to everyone. I'm Linda Birnbaum, and as Beth said, I'm the director of NIEHS, and I want to welcome you all to the Superfund Research Program's Risky Learning webinar series. This one is entitled Community Engagement, New Approaches, and Success Stories. The title of today's talk is Community Engagement Activities at Superfund Sites. As many of you are aware, one of my interests, as well as those of NIEHS and the Superfund Research Program, is to encourage community engagement in our research activities. These opportunities allow communities to take an active role in alleviating and preventing exposure to toxic substances. Seminars, such as the one today, allow our grantees to communicate their scientific accomplishments to the public, industry, and to other federal agencies. The Superfund Research Program, as well as NIEHS, has a strong history of seeking opportunities for working with communities and sharing research findings in a useful and informative manner. Furthermore, our Superfund Research Program strategic plan identifies the individuals and communities living near hazardous waste sites as key stakeholders in our research and the activities that come from the Superfund program. Over the next few months, this webinar series will feature some of the community engagement activities being undertaken by our grantees. In addition, the series will include community engagement activities from our worker education and training program at NIEHS and programs from the EPA. Today's discussion consists of two success stories of community engagement, one from a grantee funded by the Superfund Research Program. The other is from our colleagues at EPA. The first presentation will be by Anna Goodman Hoover from the University of Kentucky and is titled Using Community-Based Participatory Communication in Superfund Communities. She'll talk about the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant, a plant that produces enriched uranium for nuclear power plant, which is located near Paducah, Kentucky. She'll discuss how waste from the plant has led to contamination of the groundwater with trichloroethylene, a commonly used degreaser at the site, and with technetium-99. Our second talk will be by Sharon Lynn of Region 9 of EPA, entitled Risk Reduction Through Behavior Change. This talk will focus on activities around the Palos Verdes Shelf Superfund sites near L.A. and is one of the largest DDT and PCB contaminated sediment sites in the country. She'll speak about how her team educated local fishermen and community members about health risks of eating contaminated fish and promoting safer fishing and fish eating practices. So once again, I welcome all of you to this Risky Learning webinar series. I hope you gain new hope, new ideas, and new ways to increase the involvement of communities in both research and activities related to reduction of exposure to toxic substances. I look forward to hearing more about the types of projects that our grantees and our federal agency partners are conducting and how they are involving communities to accomplish the goals to prevent these outcomes. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Beth Anderson from the Superfund Research Program. Beth?
Okay. Thank you very much, Linda. We really appreciate your support and your interest in our community engagement activities, and also thank you for your time today and your willingness to participate. So as Dr. Birnbaum mentioned, our first speaker today is Dr. Anna Goodman Hoover. She is the communications director for the Kentucky Water Resources Research Institute at the University of Kentucky. And in addition to overseeing this resource research center public information activities, Anna serves as the University of Kentucky Superfund Research Program's Research Translation Corps and its communication liaison to the University of Kentucky's Community Engagement Corps. Okay. So Dr. Huber developed research projects intended to further the bench-to-bedside translation of environmental health research outcomes into policy, practice, and ultimately public health through the development of theory-based, methodologically rigorous communication interventions at the researcher, governmental, and community levels. So, Anna?
Thank you so much, Beth. And I'd really like to thank NIEHS for this terrific opportunity. Both Dr. Birnbaum and EPA Administrator Jackson have been such terrific proponents for community engagement methodologies, and I really think this seminar series is going to present an opportunity for us to have a lot of conversations among researchers and practitioners that help us improve the ways that we work with communities around issues of environmental risk and environmental health. Today I'm going to talk a bit about a project that we've been working on in largely rural western Kentucky for the last 2 years. Specifically, this project has taken place in the community surrounding the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant, as has been mentioned already. The PGDP is a Superfund National Priority List site that was previously operated by the U.S. Department of Energy and currently is operated by the United States Enrichment Corporation. But before I talk in great detail about our methods and the site, I think it's important to acknowledge that research, and particularly this kind of social science research, doesn't happen in a vacuum. Researchers have their own histories and perspectives. I grew up about half an hour from DOE facilities in Oak Ridge. I regularly took school trips to the American Museum of Science and Energy there. I'm from a rural area that had been dying for the last several decades as industries have continually moved out. For the last few months, the unemployment rate in my home county, where my family still lives, has been the highest in the state, hovering at above 23%. The county ranks 59th in the state for health outcomes. So as a social scientist, I cannot pretend that these biographical details don't affect my research interests or the questions I ask in the field or how I interpret the answers that I get to those questions. But other members of our research team come from different backgrounds with different experiences and commitments. Dr. Ormsby, for example, is the director of the Kentucky Water Resources Research Institute and an engineer. Dr. Onyeg Bunam is with the College of Communications and Information Studies and is the director of the Dissemination and Implementation Science Consortium. Together, we bring multiple perspectives to the table, and we integrate those with members of the community who also have different perspectives and different commitments. We can create a much richer and more comprehensive view of research problems and potential solutions. And that is why true community engagement with horizontal dialogue among participants is so essential for addressing environmental risk challenges. If you'll please turn to slide 4, I'm going to give a brief roadmap of our presentation. We're essentially going to break this down into 3 sections. I will begin by talking a little bit about community-based participatory communication, which is a qualitative research methodology that we've been using. I'll talk a little about its history, its goals, and the tools that we use in the field. Then we'll talk a little bit about the PGDP Superfund site as a case study. This is a future vision operation that we've been working on, as I said, for about 2 years. Then we'll talk a little bit about challenges and future directions for CVPC. As those of us who do participatory work know, it's not always easy. In fact, it's never easy, but it's worth it when you get to the end. So we're going to talk a little bit about those issues as well. If you'll please turn to slide 5, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this slide, but I do want to give you just a little bit of background. Action research, the coin was termed in the 1940s by Kurt Levin. And what he was describing was an approach that stresses cycles of action and reflection that involves both researchers and participants in the research. So working together toward actionable items. By the 70s, Levin's theoretical work started being translated into practical participatory methods that were used in the field, particularly in areas related to rural development. Around this time, researchers started to realize that sometimes the best answers to solutions don't just come from educated folks and the experts, but also that the indigenous knowledge of communities can really contribute to improving the quality of life around these development issues. One of the first participatory approaches that used this sort of philosophy as a guiding template was rapid rural appraisal, which used a lot of visualizations instead of questionnaires to generate discussion among semi-literate and illiterate populations. Thereby, you're no longer privileging people with a certain education level, people perhaps with a certain income level, people with certain status in the community. Instead, you're leveling the playing field because whether you read or not, everyone can look at a picture and describe what they see and what it means to them. Unfortunately, as much of an advance as rapid rural appraisal was, it was primarily still an extractive approach to conducting community research, in that once the data was collected, the researchers took that data back to their offices in their universities, often far removed from the villages and communities in which they were working, and did their own analysis without input from community members. Over time, researchers began to understand that really, community members needed to be involved in the analysis as well because their perspectives were just as valid and in some cases more so than those of the researchers who were running the project. So participatory methods continued evolving into participatory learning in action, participatory rural appraisal. And in the mid-90s, someone realized, you know, participatory approaches are using a lot of tools from the field of communications, but there aren't really communication approaches directed at specific decision-making mechanisms. And so participatory rural communication appraisal was developed. On the right side of your slide, you see the UNFAO's handbook for conducting participatory rural communication appraisal. That is available online, and one of the co-authors is actually one of the co-authors of this piece, Dr. Anya Egbunam. Participatory rural communication appraisal then evolved into community-based participatory communication, which we're about to discuss. It's been used in the field in a number of settings. It's been used around development issues in Africa. It's been used for a NIOSH study related to social marketing for tractor safety. It's being used in eastern Kentucky and Appalachia on a diabetes project. As far as we know, though, this is the first time that CBPC has been applied specifically to a Superfund community and its unique problems. If you'll turn to slide 6, I'd like to talk a little bit about the goals of community-based participatory communication. There really are 5 overarching goals, and they're very much linked with each other. We want to engage communities in a horizontal relationship that privileges both scientific expertise and the lived experience of those who live in the communities. We're looking to empower communities to have more input into the decisions that affect their lives. We want true collaborations and partnerships, not we're going to present to you what we have and then get your feedback, which may or may not be actionable on our part, really generating dialogue across different stakeholder groups. CBPC values context, realizes that each situation is specific and has its own specific qualities. Therefore, though the methods and the tools might be similar, the approach needs to be tailored to the specific question and the specific community in which you're working. And we're trying to build trust, the kind of trust that can encourage future collaborative activities, whether among the researchers in the populations or whether among different stakeholder groups in the populations who might not have been working with each other previously. If you'll please turn to slide 7, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the tools that we use to achieve these goals. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of participatory approaches use visual and projective triggers to generate discussion around important issues. Again, this levels the playing field and takes literacy issues out of the equation. By using visuals, CBPC practitioners are able to level the playing field. They're able to engage less formally educated members of the community, and we refrain from putting words in their mouths. When we ask a question, we're using language to ask that question. We're imposing a framework in which that question can be answered. By showing someone a picture, they use their own words to describe it. We're not building a wall around what they can or cannot say about what that picture or that map or that visualization might mean to them. CBPC also uses interviews and group work to generate dialogue, to identify and prioritize challenges, and to work towards solutions. Finally, CBPC methods sometimes ask participants to rank and score different options. And in trying to talk about how CBPC has adapted context specifically, I'd like you to take a look at the 2 pictures on this slide. On the left, you see a development project in Africa. These folks are looking at a piece of paper, and they are voting on different options using stones. Each participant was given a certain number of stones, and they can indicate their preferences based on what they're looking at by voting with those stones, assigning a stone to a specific choice. On the right is a picture from a focus group that we did in Paducah, and the woman is holding a keypad in her hand. What we did in that case was we showed very technically accurate computer renderings of potential future use scenarios on screen, and they used their keypads to register their preferences, actually really to score the suitability of each of the visualizations that they looked at. So while we have different research problems, we have different technical levels and different tools to address them, we're still using similar methods. If you'll please turn to slide 8, I'd like to give you a little bit of background about the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant and this future vision study in which we've been engaged. The PGDP is the only operating U.S. uranium enrichment plant right now. There are 1,200 workers at a payroll of about $121 million. Interestingly, the plant is buffered by the West Kentucky Wildlife Management Area, which is run by the state of Kentucky through an agreement with the Department of Energy. So you have this Superfund site that is surrounded by a wildlife management area. As you can see from the picture on the left, when the plant opened, it was really part of an exciting time for the area. It was called the Atomic City, and folks really thought that they were on the cutting edge of future technology. In 1988, trichloroethylene and technetium-99 were found in nearby private drinking wells, however, leading to the site's classification on the national priority list in 1994. That is one of the largest TCE plumes in the world, with enough TCE in the groundwater to fill 16,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. If all the residual sources of the TCE were removed, complete natural remediation is expected to take more than 100 years. So this plant will be closing in the next 5 to 10 years. As you can imagine, in a largely rural area, a $121 million payroll going away would have a massive economic impact. We have been asked to come in and work with the community to identify some acceptable future uses for the site after the DOE has moved out, after USEC has moved out, and uranium enrichment activities cease. For project guidance, we were given a publication known as The Politics of Cleanup, which was published by the Energy Communities Alliance in 2007. This publication identified lessons learned from DOE community involvement processes in Rocky Flats, Colorado, Mound, Ohio, and Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Essentially, we were wanting to engage local stakeholders in determining how both the cleanup and the future use goals would support or advance local needs, because really, one thing that we learned from Politics of Cleanup is that future use decisions that are made unilaterally without input from community members run the risk of being inconsistent with those local needs, as well as with the core values held by local governments and others in the affected communities. If you'll turn to slide 9, we can talk about the project goals, which directly relate to these issues. We really wanted to involve communities in visioning for site remediation use and monitoring, and that's involving throughout the process. And we wanted to ensure that future use goals could help advance the local needs and values. To accomplish these goals, we knew that we needed to discover value systems, risk perceptions, preferences for various facets of the future vision question, and perspectives about cleanup issues. We also wanted to engage in emergent design by involving the community in identifying the potential future uses. The results could then be used in broad-based community forums to allow people to measure their preferences for specific future outcomes as thoroughly and accurately as possible. So how did we go about achieving these goals? Please turn to the next slide. Ultimately, given the complexity of the issues, we elected to use a mixed methods approach. We felt that gathering both qualitative and quantitative data would allow us to triangulate our findings, improve our explanations of phenomena, increase the credibility of our conclusions, and generate such a diversity of data related to the research questions. Community-based participatory communication was selected as the qualitative basis for our project, and the developers of structured public involvement and case-wise visualization were brought in to provide the quantitative basis. SPI has been used extensively for public infrastructure projects such as bridge design, and it uses computer renderings, large public meetings, and handheld keypads to allow community members to evaluate various scenarios related to specific research problems. So you can see how it is a complementary method to some of the tools used by community-based participatory communication. Case-wise visual evaluation can then use those scenario data and fuzzy set modeling techniques to predict community evaluations for unsampled scenarios. Unfortunately, I don't really have time to go into a great deal of detail about SPI or CAVE or to talk through all of the steps of our process, but more detail can be found on the www.paducahvision.com website from the title slide, or feel free to contact me after the seminar and I'll be happy to put you in touch with the SPI team. One advantage of multidisciplinary mixed methods approaches is that researchers become familiar with tools that may be outside of their particular field of study. In this case, the SPI team brought with them a public engagement metric from the geography field that helped us shape the rest of the Paducah Visioning project. If you look to the right of your slide, you can see the Arnstein Ladder of Public Participation. This was developed in 1969 by Sherry Arnstein, and it provides a measurement of public involvement levels from non-participation to tokenism to community control. You can see the ladder here on the right side of your slide. Reading up from the bottom, you have manipulation followed by therapy, in which individuals who disagree with a specific decision are essentially told that the problem is their own point of view. You then have informing, which is self-explanatory. Placation, as described by Arnstein, involves the limited participation of a select few community members. In consultation, citizen opinions are solicited, but there's no guarantee that they're going to be actionable. Partnership provides for active negotiations between citizens and power holders. Delegated power is an evolution of partnership in which citizen opinions become the dominant driver of decisions, and citizen control involves citizen ownership and governance of decisions. So the research team elected to incorporate the Arnstein Ladder as a metric in both the CBPC and SPI portions of our research protocols.
Excuse me, Anna. This is Beth. This is very fascinating, and I know we've got short time, but can you slow down a little bit for... You're presenting some complex things. help if you can slow a little down.
I certainly can, Beth.
Thank you.
So how did we integrate the qualitative and the quantitative methods into this coherent approach? If you'll turn to the next slide, we'll do an overview. We began with a listening tour, which is CBPC-based, and we did that as an iterative process of identifying affected individuals and groups. In addition to asking them basic facts about what was going on in the community, what related to the future visioning issue, we also asked them to identify other stakeholders in the process, because we're in Lexington. We're 4 to 5 hours from Paducah, depending on how fast you drive and how many laws you break. So we needed to get more of a sense of what's going on the ground there. And each interview we ended by asking specifically who else should be involved. From that, and I'll get in more detail on this in just a moment, we created a list of specific stakeholder groups, and from those groups we created a pilot test panel that worked in parallel to the process, pre-testing the protocols at each step to make sure that they were appropriate for the specific community, culturally, that we were providing the right amount of information, not too much, not too little. We didn't want to overwhelm people. We didn't want to cover bases that they already understood and knew. So they were very helpful in those steps. We then went on to do CBPC-based stakeholder focus groups that I'll talk about in detail in just a moment. And then we did community open houses, which I'll touch on, and then the community scenario scoring, which was the SPI portion of the protocol. If you'll turn to slide 12, we can discuss the individual CBPC-based steps in more depth. The listening tour protocol, you can see here the questions that we wanted to get to as we talked to individual stakeholders. By the end of the project, we'd spoken to about 66 individuals in either one-on-one meetings or sometimes in small group interviews. We gave an overview of the project and process, and then we wanted to know their concerns, opportunities, perceived challenges, long-term visions for the development or lack of development of that site after uranium enrichment ceases at the plant. We also wanted to know what else we needed to know. Are there political issues in the field that we need to be aware of? Are there groups that are don't necessarily get along that we need to be wary of? What kinds of issues do we need to know? And who should be involved? Again, that's the snowball sampling question. Can you tell us who we haven't mentioned who might need to be involved in the process? for example, with this conference call, I can look at the list of people participating, and I could, from the outside, say, well, we have agencies participating, we have NGOs participating, we have consultants, we have community groups, and I could impose upon you all a stakeholder grouping that prescribed to my own preconceived notions of what your information needs and wants and capabilities are. But in talking to you as individuals, I might determine that really federal and state agencies have different kinds of needs. Or NIH personnel and FEMA people and EPA people bring different sets of skills to the table, so I really should segregate those out. But the bottom line is, unless I privilege your voice as a CBC practitioner, unless I go in and ask you and talk to you about these things, I can't really know, and I'm just guessing as a researcher far removed from the actual field. If you'll turn to page 13, we can talk a little bit about the stakeholders that we did determine. I don't have a whole lot of time to get into this slide, but you can see here who all these folks were. Residents who live near the plant whose municipal water is supplied by DOE because of contamination issues, employees of the plant, various kinds of employees of the plant, regulatory agencies, the PGDP Citizens Advisory Board. You can see there that there are a number of folks. And what we wanted to do was talk with each group individually to find out what the specific perspectives and needs of that group were related to the future visioning question. But unfortunately, logistically, it just wasn't possible to hold 16 separate meetings. So what we did was we looked back at our listening tour data, and we synthesized some groups who had similar commitments and similar needs into the same focus group. So, for example, we decided that USDOE employees and subcontractors were similar enough in their perspectives and needs based on our interviews that we could have focus groups with those groups together. Sort of the same thing with economic development and local government interests, as well as health professionals and educators who play similar roles in the community related to the plant. But what do we do once we got everyone in the room together? If you can turn to slide 14, please, we can look at the focus group protocol. Again, there were several steps in the protocol, but I would like to focus on the three CBPC-based steps. The Arnstein ladder became an important part of this exercise. Then we talked about community values, and we're going to talk a little bit about information gaps. So if you'll turn to slide 15, please. With the Arnstein ladder, and if you need to refer back, the ladder itself is on page 10 of your slideshow. With the Arnstein ladder, we asked participants two questions. We asked, in your past experience of issues related to the PGDP, how involved have you as a community member felt that you could be? Given past public meetings, past engagement efforts from different agencies, where are we now on that ladder of participation? And as you can see here, their scores were between a 3 and a 4. That is between informing and placation in the tokenism section of the ladder. But then when we asked them, well, ideally, where should we be, the mean was close to a 6, which is partnership. Two things are clear from these means. One is that we're doing community engagement, but we may not be engaging as successfully as we think we are, and we're not going to know until we ask the people in the communities in which we work. Secondly, we need to realize that community members recognize the role for technical expertise. The ideal levels of participation were not about we want to make all the decisions. It should be completely community-driven decisions. They recognize that there should be a partnership between community knowledge and lived experience and the knowledge that technical and scientific experts bring to the table. So these are a couple of important takeaways, but there's one really interesting phenomenon that emerges if you pull apart the stakeholder groups and look at their Arnstein scoring independently. If you'll turn to slide 16, please, and I just note this because it's a very provocative issue that we might look at exploring in future research. Stakeholder groups that express the lowest level of perceived involvement in decision making also indicated the highest expectations for ideal involvement levels. So we're not really sure. This is a correlation, and we have no clue about directionality. Could it be that individuals who feel that they've been the least engaged in decision-making compensate by setting higher ideals for true engagement? Or do individuals who perceive lower levels of involvement do so because they started with higher expectations? It's really a provocative research question, one that I think we can start looking at in future projects. If you'll turn to slide 17, please, I'd like to shift gears to the community values portion of the protocol. In the community values exercises, we went around the room and asked each participant in the focus group to name three things that he or she liked most about living in the community. We wrote the answers on easel pads in the front of the room, and we then went around the room again and asked each participant to name three qualities of the ideal place to live. We also wrote those down. Often the answer to the two questions were very similar. This slide summarizes the values data collected across the eight focus groups. It's important to note that these categories emerged in every focus group. It's not like we went into the economic development focus group and they said it's all about jobs and nothing about environmental stewardship. Or that we went into the environmental groups and they said it's all about environmental stewardship, jobs are unimportant. Each side recognized the importance of all of these values, but what was different was how they weighed them and how they saw the two as relating. One participant, for example, said, what we need is sustainable jobs and an environmentally safe and sound future to preserve the environment not only now but in the future. It wouldn't just be any jobs, it would be jobs that would keep those values in mind as well. So later in the protocol, we asked participants to think about specific hypothetical scenarios within the context of these values and to weigh how particular future uses might support or conflict with specific categories. The results of those discussions are going to be included in our final project report, and that will be posted on that PaducaVision.com website within a few weeks. During the scenario discussions, as well as the subsequent information gaps portion of the protocol, a number of issues emerged over and over again about which participants wanted more information in order to feel comfortable that they were making valid assessments for specific future uses. People wanted to know, and I'm quoting here, the truth about what is out there, exactly how toxic is it out there, accurate environmental risk information, environmental impacts of each scenario. So there were really complex questions. We came away from those sessions with 100 questions. One community member said, we need objective information, not just hysteria. Unfortunately, identifying credible sources for that information was somewhat more difficult. As you can see up in the community values list, trust and open and honest communication are both important to the community, and a number of participants asked this, sort of indicated that that's because they have not always been readily available. One participant said, you can pretty much ask anybody in the community this part. I don't know who we trust anymore. It's the point that we don't trust anybody. So we found ourselves in the position of needing to collect and provide accurate scientific, technical, and historical information to a somewhat skeptical audience. If you'll turn to slide 18, I'll discuss a little bit how we went about doing that. What we did was we held two public information meetings, one in McCracken County and one in Ballard County. We used an interactive quiz show format, we distilled the 100 questions down into 30 and grouped them around the past, the present, the future, science, and cleanup. Each answer included references to existing information resources. This particular project represents one of the truest collaborations of CBPC and SPI in this project because the information gaps were identified through CBPC, and we tried to use a democratic format for presenting that information to the people, but we used SPI technology and methods to get there. So a sample question has to do with wind power, what the average wind speed needs to be, for an area to be suitable resources for wind development. And then we would show multiple choice questions. People would register what they thought the correct answer was. If you look at the slide, you can see that we would show people what the distribution around the room was, how many people thought it was this answer, how many people thought it was that answer. And then we gave the correct answer, showing maps of Kentucky wind speeds and wind power from other cited sources. Two things I think really helped us here. We cited our sources, and we used multiple sources wherever they were available. We had discussion after the questions, and we provided comment cards with opportunities for participants to cite alternative data sources if they disagreed with something that we said. Despite having these public information meetings in two counties and a number of participants, we didn't get a single comment card back that disagreed with the actual factual information that we provided. So we think that speaks a lot to how the credibility of this meeting was viewed. All of the questions, answers, and supporting data from this exercise are available in the FAQ section of the Paducah Vision website. If you'll turn to slide 19, I'll discuss quickly some of the broader outcomes of the project, but not too quickly, Beth. We have increased knowledge of PGDP-related issues and available resources. As with a lot of Superfund communities, especially federal facilities communities, there's a lot of misinformation. There are urban legends, so we wanted to provide people with access to existing sources that are out there. We also increased awareness of the pending closure and potential future uses of the site. This site being closed has been talked about for years and years to the point that it's become white noise for a lot of people in the community. But what we did was we reminded people this is on the horizon and helped mobilize the community around these discussions for future use. We provided capacity building experience and collaborative visioning. By having these experiences and looking at the scenarios and evaluating what kinds of information they're going to need, they can take that forward to the next step in the process. And we documented community values and scenario preferences for future advocacy. And again, that will be included in the final report that will be posted to the website. If you'll turn to slide 20, I just want to show you quickly the process rating we received. The process in the focus groups was viewed quite well across the board. I would like to point out that the lowest scoring group was the Water Policy District residents. Those are arguably some of the most disaffected people in that community. And if you recall from your Arnstein Ladder scoring, they had some of the lowest perceived levels of community involvement, but some of the highest expectations for community involvement. So I really feel like getting a 6 from those folks means a lot. Thus far, what I've talked about, though, has been largely positive, but I think it's important to recognize the challenges we're dealing with when we work in communities, especially around complex environmental risk-related issues. If you'll turn to slide 21, I'll discuss some of these quickly, and I'm sure that there will be questions about these in the question and answer period, but some of these sites have been dealing with Superfund issues and environmental risk issues for decades, so you have built up a lot of distrust. So there are legacy trust issues and entrenched belief systems that are built around urban legends or misinformation. So when you come in from the outside as a researcher, sometimes it's hard not to get caught up in that. Sometimes citizens' perceptions of you as being part of that process, part of the people they don't trust. You're funded by the federal government, say, and maybe there are some constituencies that don't feel the federal government is that trustworthy at this point because they've been going round and round for 20 years. Or you are the federal government, so how do you set yourself apart from that? That's a real challenge. And obviously there are competing academic and community knowledges and languages. We in academia, as well as agencies, have a tendency to speak in alphabet soup. We have an acronym for everything, and we just tend to lose people. We have a lot of real highly technical jargon that we use. So finding the middle ground, how can we talk about these complex issues in ways that make sense and are actionable by communities is a real challenge. And evaluation, how do you decide a community-based participatory communication project has been successful? Is it only if the most preferred scenario is what happens at the site? Is it if groups that participated that previously weren't talking across the aisle start collaborating on new projects? Is it with really high process evaluations? What does a successful community-based participatory communication project look like? And I know that some folks have proposed logic models, which are a really interesting approach and one way of doing it. There's one issue when you're doing qualitative research that a certain segment of the scientific community doesn't always believe is credible because it is qualitative in nature. If you start using program metrics to look at research, do you then devalue it as research in the perceptions of some segments of the scientific community? These are complicated questions that we really need to work through. If we'll turn to slide 22, I'll just talk about a few future directions for CBPC that have grown out of this effort. First, as I noticed, we're working on trying to understand better how these communities construct and balance competing risks. Obviously, there's a whole body of literature on decision-making and risk science, but really in seeing how these communities are working through economic versus environmental risk issues, I think there's going to be some interesting data that come out of this that can examine that question further within the context of that existing literature. We're looking at creating emergency response plans. Very often when we're making emergency response plans, subject matter experts sit around a table and say, well, this is what they need to do, and therefore we're going to put it out there. But if you bring community members to that table, you can discover better what kinds of adaptations in an emergency situation are most actionable within that community. There are barriers that you may not know about because you don't live there, and those can be brought to light. Similarly, we're looking at that kind of process in the creation of agency risk communication policies and in informing the creation of health literacy interventions. So I think that all of these are viable areas to move into with community-based participatory communication. The next slide is just the acknowledgement slide. I'd like to thank every one of those people, but given time, I won't go down the list. And I thank you for your time and your attention, and I hope we have a really good discussion. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Anna. This is really an enlightening presentation. I think your data really raises many, many thought-provoking questions, so look forward to further discussion with you. I will open the call up for questions and answers for a few minutes, and we'll start with does anyone on the phone line have a question for Dr. Hoover?
Hi. This is a great presentation. This is Bill Sook. I have a question. One of the important things that you're getting, that you're presenting here, is the ability to increase credibility over time. This project's going to go on for a long time. I mean, there's a heck of a lot of TCE there. I mean, we're talking 100 years, maybe more. What kind of plan is there for the future to ensure its sustainability over an extended period of time, essentially from one generation to the next? And that's a hard question, and maybe but I'm sure you've given it some thought.
Thank you, Dr. Sook. Actually, we have been thinking a lot about that question. Right now for the public meetings, and we've noted this as a limitation in our current version of our report, we don't have enough participants at this stage to feel confident in the statistical validity of the quantitative portion of this study. So what we're doing is we're even continuing the process now. We're going into the field. We've set up additional meetings. We're gathering additional data. But the nice thing about the SPI component of this process, which I didn't really touch on too much, is that these visualizations have been created. We tried to sample the entire spectrum of potential future uses, from absolutely no future use, institutional controls, put a fence up, never let humans on the site again, all the way down to a very complicated high-end use like a nuclear power plant being there. So, and we tried to sample different uses in between. There was an industrial use, a light industrial use. So what we did was we by spanning the spectrum and creating these visualizations, we can take those back to the people over and over again, and using those visualizations, and as the parameters change, if funding changes and some things become more possible than others, we can then create new scenarios, but the bones are in place to continue this study. The bones are in place to continue working on these issues, and we plan to turn our data over to the community so that they can say, okay, right now this is where we stand. And if certain future use decisions are either in line with or directly opposed to what that data says, they can then take that to their elected representatives and say, have a look at this again and let us know what we can do to promote this use or not to promote this use. But the process is there and adaptable as the situation changes. So that's a long way of getting to really a short answer.
Thank you, Anna. Kind of along the same time frame question is one of the questions that came in on the web was that what is the time frame of this project? I guess that would be when did you start it, and obviously you're still in process, but.
Our first project team meetings were in the fall of 2008, I believe, when we started trying to decide, okay, this is what we've been tasked to do. What kind of expertise do we need to bring together? Then we started recruiting our team members. As I said, Dr. Anya Egbunam brings a very specific background in community-based participatory processes. from the College of Communication. We were appointed to the folks doing structured public involvement in engineering. So we started having our first real processual team meetings in the spring of 2008. We spent a couple of months getting things in line, and then we started doing interviews in 2009. We did about 4 to 5 months of interviews. We then pilot-tested focus group protocols, took about 5 months to get IRB turned around on that, and did all the focus groups in a week. Spent the summer analyzing the data, but did all the focus groups in a week. And then that was in May of 2010. In October, we held, the first half of October, we did the public information meetings. The last half of October, we did scenario scoring meetings, where people had keypads and looked at the specific scenarios. So we've been writing the report since October, but as I just mentioned, we've added some meetings that weren't really in our original scope, just simply to continue building this data set. We would like to get as much input from the community as possible, because the data is really only as good as the participants. And as you know, 20 years down the line of Superfund issues, people have been to a lot of public meetings. People have filled out a lot of questionnaires, and you hit this point where you have participation fatigue. People have kids, they have families, they have things to do, and why should I go to another meeting? So there's really some time in the credibility and trust building phase where you have to let people know that this is different. This is something that you are an active participant in, and we really need you there so that they can talk it up to their friends and neighbors. I can't tell you how many times we heard, why isn't so-and-so here? My neighbor should be here. Why don't we have more people here? And people saying they would go back to their neighbors and their family members and encourage them to come to future public meetings. So it's really a process. And that trust-building component is so key to participation levels. But I think that we've got something started here that is going to be very valuable for how we do community engagement around these environmental risk and environmental health issues.
Okay. Well, we have a lot of interesting questions coming in online, but I do want to go back and go back for another question or to the phone lines and remind you, if you're on the phone, to be unmute your line, press *6, and I'll take another question from the phone. Well, while you continue to think, I will go back and have a question here online.
I have a question.
Okay.
I was wondering if this CBPC process is significantly more expensive than the general process we have. It seems like there's a lot of technology as well as time of the employees. And if we're talking technical, we need contractors, community involvement corps and the like, I'm just wondering if, outside of the research aspect, if implementing it is clearly more expensive.
Well, in this particular process, we did use a lot of technology because we had it available with the integration with the SPI personnel. They had the keypads. They had the technology to produce these visualizations. But as I noted in the roots of CBPC and the tools of CBPC, you know, we can do this work in villages with no electricity. You know, I mean, we can draw maps on the ground with a stick and have people vote with rocks for what they think the best solution is. So I guess the short answer to a complicated question, because we haven't really done a cost analysis in depth, is that you can do it with as project requires and the funding allows. It's just how many bells and whistles do you weave into the basic methods, because, again, what's important are the bones of the process, less so than the specifics of what you're doing to get there.
Okay, so that kind of was one of the other questions, was what do you estimate a project like this would cost, and you said that you really haven't done the cost analysis on it yet, is that correct?
Well, this specific project, because of the SPI integration, and we spent a lot of money on software for that interface because they developed these very complex visualizations using Google mapping and ArcView and all kinds of things, I believe this entire 2-year project was about a little over $400,000 for the 2-plus years plus planning and implementation.
Okay, thank you. I think I will take one more phone
a question from on the phone lines, if anyone has a question. Well, I actually have quite a list of questions that came in online, but I think it's probably a good breaking point to turn over or to look to our next presentation for today, and we can come back to some of these other questions that came in during the final Q&A, and also I'm certain you'll be willing to answer questions online afterwards, too. But
absolutely.
Again, many thanks, Anna. I really, really appreciate it. And so our next presentation for today is Sharon Lynn, who is currently on detail in the U.S. EPA Environmental Justice Program Office, and she's focusing on community capacity building and integrating environmental justice in EPA programs. Ms. Lynn was a project manager with U.S. EPA Superfund Program in the Pacific Southwest region from 2002 to 2010. In that capacity, Ms. Lynn was responsible for managing cleanup activities at two contaminated sediment Superfund sites in California, including Palos Verdes Shelf Superfund site. Sharon has 15 years of experience working in the field of contaminated sediment management, ranging from technical, policy, to community-related issues. She holds a bachelor's degree in chemistry and a graduate degree in civil engineering, with an emphasis on environmental engineering from San Jose State University. And she's a registered professional engineer. So, Sharon, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Beth, and thanks for this opportunity to share the PV Shelf, Palos Verdes Shelf, Superfund story with all the folks on the line. As a Superfund site, I just want to say that our approach is really focusing on risk and addressing risk reduction. And three takeaways from this presentation. First is our experience using community-based social marketing techniques to compel behavior change, hence risk reduction. And second point is using the technology that is available to create public transparency of our work. And third, probably most importantly, is using strategic planning tools and neutral facilitation for project planning. So we're on slide 25, the first slide. I want to give everybody a background of Palos Verdes Shelf Superfund site. The site is off of the California coast in Los Angeles County. Palos Verdes Peninsula lies between Santa Monica Bay and the harbors of Long Beach and Los Angeles. What you're seeing is a 3D map generated by USGS. It really shows how complex the site is. And if you look at where the circle is, PV Shelf margin, the shelf itself is about 9 miles long and about 1.5 mile wide, and it just drops 2,500 feet to San Pedro Basin. You saw the steep drop. This is very important in terms of thinking about engineering control, as we call it in Superfund, remedy, to clean up the contaminant sediments on the shelf. So slide 26 and slide 27 talks a little bit about where the DDT comes from. The DDT and the PCBs got on the shelf because of historical industrial use. From 1950s to 1971, Montrose Chemical Company in Torrance, California, was a primary source of DDT. They were the largest DDT manufacturer at that time in the country and in the world. For decades, they were able to discharge DDT and PCB from other industry facilities into the LA County sewer system, where after treatment at the wastewater treatment facility, the effluent was discharged into the ocean and onto the outfalls at White Point on the Palos Verdes Shelf. So over time, the elliptical-shaped contaminated sediment deposit formed over 17 square miles of the shelf and the slope. And the size and depth and the slope really limited our remediation options. And on slide 28 talks a little bit about the history of the site from the 1947 to 71, you see that the Montrose Chemical Company discharges the wastewater into the sewers. And around late 1950s, scientists began to investigate the severe declines in populations of bald eagles, peregrine falcons, and several species of marine birds that inhabit Southern California. They noted reproductive failure associated with egg thinning and identified the culprit as DDT. High levels of DDT were found in those birds, as well as in sediments, fish, invertebrates, and marine mammals. High levels of another group of industry chemicals, PCBs, were also found in the wildlife and the fish. In 1986, State of California issued a draft fish advisory, mainly due to the significantly high level of DDTs and PCBs in the local marine fish. In 1990, State of California closed the Palos Verdes Shelf to commercial fishing of white croaker. In 1998, the state again issued recreational and sport fishing catch limit of 10 white croaker per day per back for sports fishermen. And also in 1997, contaminated white croaker were found in fish markets, mostly in ethnic fish markets in the Los Angeles and Orange County area in Southern California. In the 1990s, the Natural Resource Trustees took legal action against the polluters, and EPA joined the lawsuit in 1997. The last settlement was reached in 2000. Which gives EPA $64 million to clean up the site, to reduce the human health risks. And it also gives $62 million for the trustees for natural resource restoration at the site. So slide 29 talks a little bit about the Superfund program at the Palos Verdes Shelf. There were two approaches that we are concurrently undertaking. One is to reduce the immediate exposure, human health exposure, and we're using our 9-ton critical removal action authority under CERCLA, and we're implementing an institutional controls program. What institutional controls program means is really to use non-engineering control to reduce human health risks. And concurrently, we have a remedial process that's going on. We've completed the remedial investigation and feasibility about 2 years ago. We issued a proposed plan and interim ROD last year proposing to cap portion of the Palos Verdes Shelf. Slide 30 shows visually what we meant by institutional controls. So the primary goal of this three-pronged approach is to reduce human health risk through public outreach and education, fish monitoring both at local markets and in the ocean, and enforcement of existing fishing regulations. They're both state-issued regulations. And slide number 31 is a conceptual site model for institutional controls program. As you can see from the diagram, what we're trying to describe or investigate is the potential risk exposure route from the contaminated fish to the table, how the fish goes from the ocean to the table. So there are various exposure routes. For example, for the recreational fish, they are fishermen and recreational fishermen in boats or pier fishing fishermen. there will be catching fish and then either selling them to fish markets or selling directly to restaurants or given to families and friends for consumption. So that's one of the potential route of exposure. And we did that for various scenarios, including recreational fishing as well as commercial fishing. And then our program is really based on the conceptual site model and the potential risk exposure scenario. So on page, on slide 32, we are working with communities and local and state agencies to reduce risk. So there are about 20 entities that we're working with. What you see, the three pictures here really show the scope of the partners that we're working with on this project. The top picture is a warden from California Department of Fish and Game and L.A. County Environmental Health Inspectors doing a market inspection in a local fish market in L.A. area. Again, it's an ethnic market. They historically has been selling white croakers in the market, and they're doing routine inspection to educate and also enforce fishing regulations. And the next picture is an outreach worker on the pier outreaching to a pier, shore-based pier fisherman about the contaminated fish issues and precautions he can take on what kind of fish he can fish to reduce his risk. The bottom picture is a community outreach event where community-based organization, in this case, is a Boat People SOS, a Vietnamese community-based organization doing a class, an educational class on contaminated fish at an ESL class in Orange County. And also I want to talk a little bit about how we narrow down the communities that we're engaging for this project. A couple years ago, we did a study called the CAB study. It's called Consumption Attitude and Behavior Study, where we looked about at about 9 communities in the LA and Orange County area. We looked at their fish eating patterns, their fishing patterns, and how they cook and consume the fish. And also we looked at where white croaker, which is the most contaminated fish in the area, where they're showing up in terms of geographic coverage of the markets. And we've narrowed down to the two most at-risk communities. There are Vietnamese and the Chinese communities for the commercial piece, but for the recreational is really the pier angler. And in Southern California, about 75 to 80% of pier-based anglers are Hispanic or Spanish speaking anglers. So slide 33 and 34 talks a little bit about this collaborative that we formed for the public outreach and education project. It's called Fish Contamination Education Collaborative. The collaborative has approximately 20 local, state, federal, and community organizations working together to address the risk issue associated with consuming contaminated fish from PV shelf. As a group, we were able to pull our resources and jointly achieve what alone just might be totally impossible. We worked together on common goals and used all levels of government to protect the most vulnerable populations. Slide 35, as I mentioned earlier, that we narrowed down the most vulnerable populations. Let me just go back a little bit. When we first started this project in 2003, we did a lot of public outreach and education. We did significant work on awareness raising through using community-based participatory principles. We reached a lot of people. We reached folks from Korean, Chinese, Vietnamese, Pacific Islander, Latino, Filipino, and African American communities. We reached more than 100,000 people. But one question we keep asking ourselves is, what are these people doing with the information that they receive from us? What were they doing to protect their health? Were there any behavior change as a result of the awareness-raising campaign that we've been doing for a while? And I think that's the dilemma and the question we ask in a lot of public outreach and education efforts. Is our efforts effective, and how do we quantify the results of our work? So slide 36 really shows this community-based social marketing tool. So this funnel of community-based social marketing pictured here really depicts the targeted outreach mechanism. And FCEC, the Fish Contamination Education Collaborative, is a perfect example of successfully identifying and reaching out to the public using surveys to pre-evaluate, implement, and post-evaluate, which I'll go into detail at a later slide. One of the important components of the EPA's program is really the scientific and data, which is the monitoring program. The monitoring program evaluates and tracks contaminant concentrations in white croaker and other fish caught at or near Palos Verde shelf, as well as white croakers sold in fish markets. From 2002 and 2004, EPA and the trustees conducted a fish in the ocean monitoring program to gather data for the state to update their fish advisory and to reevaluate the commercial catch ban area. Additionally, EPA's remedy calls for periodic sampling of the fish to track any changes in contaminant concentrations. Under the marketplace monitoring program, EPA is sampling white croakers from local fish markets on a periodic basis in collaboration with our local health inspectors, as well as the community-based organization members. Under the peer fishing monitoring program, we monitor which fish anglers are catching on the pier and periodically measure the contaminant levels in fishermen's bucket. So this is very important because that's where we get the direct measure of contaminants and the risk, what people are consuming from the buckets. And we also added a component that we call behavior monitoring, where we use, again, the CBSM, focus on the quantitative measure of behavior change. We look at anglers' fishing behavior pre and post intervention. We look at, we track the community's fish consumption behavior, again, pre and post intervention. Slide 38 is the enforcement program. I think enforcement program is really critical and essential to have a program that's results oriented. The state and the local agency primarily carry out the enforcement. EPA has, we have cooperative agreements with local and state agencies to help fund the enforcement component of the program. For example, the California Fish and Game patrols the Palos Verde shelf to ensure the catch ban is not, there are no illegal fishing activities in the catch ban area, and also the enforcing the bag limit. The local environmental health departments inspect fish markets to make sure fish come from legitimate sources. And the two pictures that you see are the warden from California Department of Fish and Game, as well as the LA County inspectors doing market inspections. Slide 39 talks about the strategic planning process that we use for the project. Strategic planning is a process that where our program, the Institutional Controls Program, is continuously improved. All the partners, the 20-plus partners, participate in the process to achieve our common goal of risk reduction. We use strategic planning tools to develop a living document that we call the roadmap that guides the IC's program. And the roadmap also includes an implementation plan with specific tasks to develop and implement various work plans and contracts. And what's really important with the roadmap, we also set a quantitative risk reduction goal under each activity based on the baseline data that we've gathered. So it's very quantitative. And we continuously refine the roadmap with input from all partners and share our results with the group and external stakeholders. And our strategic planning meetings take place every 6 months, and we use a neutral facilitator. And EPA, me, I, and my colleagues are just equal partners at the table, and we're equal participants. And we find that process very helpful in terms of engaging the communities and other agencies so they have an equal say in the direction of this program. Slide 40 talks about a little bit about the technology we've used to create public transparency as well as use as a communication tool with the public, general public, and our stakeholders. We've been using this technology for about past few years. We started with a website, which is pbsfish.org, and then we put an interactive GIS map on the homepage where the information that we upload to the site on the inspection enforcement, on the monitoring, on the outreach, where the public can get the information as soon as I get the information as the EPA project manager. So this is really helpful in terms of we communicate our progress and sharing our information with the people who are interested in that at the site. So the last I checked was last year that our website receives greater than about 10,000 unique visitors every month. And then we have continuous and frequent content updates for the site. So page 41, slide 41 is a little bit about the latest edition we had last year, which is the FCC blog. We post weekly, so the topics include updates on the program happenings, events, highlights of the partners events, posts on fish advisories, posts from pier, what's being caught and what's running, and we feature photos and videos. Page 42 showed a blog that's posted by one of partners in the L.A., San Gabriel Valley area from the Chinese community. The purpose is really to allow interaction with the web visitors through the blog comments. And then the blog also is linked up with our homepage, website, Facebook, e-newsletter, YouTube, and Flickr. Slide 43 shows just a snapshot of our website translation. The website is available in various languages, Chinese, Vietnamese, and Spanish. And it offers an opportunity to present in-language materials for our target audience in the area. Our partners help with the translations, so it's a really inclusive effort that are continuing, bring us together on updating the information for the target audience. Slide 44 is really the core of the community-based social marketing strategy. We use a process that's based on the principles from behavior science. The five steps of the CBSM include, first, identify a specific behavior in which the target audience should engage, and it needs to be short and succinct. Number two is determining barriers and motivators to engaging in the desired behavior. Number three is to develop interventions that will break down barriers or promote motivators. Number four is to implement a pilot. Number five is evaluate intervention strategy. And it really goes in a cycle. As I mentioned before, that we identify Vietnamese and Chinese communities are most at-risk populations because of the types of fish they consume and how often they consume it and how they consume it. For example, those two communities tend to consume most whole fish in soups or stews, and our sampling results showed for DDTMP CBs, the whole fish consumption pattern really gives a 10 times greater, higher concentration, hence greater risk. So our message is very succinct and simple, basically, just eat fillet. And so by changing that behavior, just one little behavior for eating fillet, we can reduce risk by tenfold. And I want to show a little bit result. The slide 45 shows the results of intervention. So what we did is the intervention was done at local community health clinics and ESL classes. About 250 community members were tested for immediate retention of the message. And then 30 days later, about 150 of the people were phone interviewed to see if they still remember, if they still retain the message, which is eat fillet. So here are the results. The blue represents before outreach. The yellow represents post-outreach. Here, our goal is not to stop fish consumption, but really to change how the fish was prepared and consumed. So I think the data was successful in terms of showing that we were able to, slide 46, we were able to increase the skinless fish fillet consumption rate at the same time that slide 47 reduced the whole fish consumption pattern. And then on slide 48, we were successful at showing that the overall consumption increased the desired behavior of overall consuming skinless fish fillets. So that's on the community consumption, fish consumption side. The other piece is on the fishermen side. Slide 49 showed a pilot that we did at two fishing piers in the area. The Belmont Pier is one of the fishing spots that receives regular outreach, so the fishermen that who frequent that site have a really good basic understanding and knowledge of the fish contamination issue and the behavior change that they can undertake to reduce their risk. And the Belmont Pier is an intervention site where we've never done outreach before. So the goal of the outreach is really to reduce the amount of white croaker anglers taking home to their families and to their communities. So the assessment has three components, baseline survey, outreach intervention, and follow-up survey. So the following slides, 50, 51, 52, 53, there was actually a series of animated slides, but I'm not able to show animation, so there are individual slides. So it really showed how the outreach intervention was done. So the baseline survey occurred during May to June 2008. We collected 177 data points at both pairs. Intervention was conducted from September to October 2008. We collected about 300 data points using the outreach material, the tip card that you see on slide 50. Post-intervention data were collected from October to November 2008. We collected 57 data points. We spent 7 weekends at the Belmont Pier and 9 weekends at Rainbow Harbor Pier. So slide 54 showed the results of, we asked for intention for white croaker caught. again, the pre and post, the blue is a pre, the yellow is a post. So as a pre intervention, 26% of anglers we interviewed said they were going to eat the white croakers themselves. 36% of them said they were going to take it home to friends and family. 41% were doing catch and release, which is the message that we want them to receive, is if you catch white croaker, just release it. And then after intervention and the post-survey show there is a significant decrease in the intention of eating the white croaker or taking it home to the family and friends, and the catch and release intention has increased significantly. The next one is the anglers leading with white croakers. So the outreach workers actually on the pier counting, looking at the fishermen's buckets, the type of fish, and counting the anglers who are leading the pier with white croakers. So we, again, see significant reduction, especially at Rainbow Pier, Rainbow Harbor Pier, where after intervention, we see a 56% of decrease of angler leaving the pier with white croakers. So that point is very important because we know what's leaving the pier is what's going to the community. In addition, as I mentioned earlier in one of the previous slides, that we took the fish from the fishermen's buckets in some instances, and we measured the PCB and DDT concentration in those fish. And we were able to do a mini risk assessment looking at exposure, obviously, and the concentration, and we demonstrated quantitatively through this behavior change that there is a significant risk reduction throughout work. Slide 56 showed some of the recognition and national awards the project has received. Citizen Excellence Award in Community Involvement by EPA Headquarters Superfund and the National EJ Awards. So we're extremely honored of the recognition that we received by Headquarters and the national group. So my last slide is question and discussion. Some of the key points to take home is, first, we need to set clear goals for community work at the site. We need to really distinguish if our goal is to raise awareness versus behavior change, because our program needs to be designed and delivered in different manner if our goals are different. And second, if behavior change is the goal, then we need to have a scientific approach to outreach and education. We need to show strong linkage between human controls and engineering controls at Superfund sites, and we need to seriously consider strategic planning as a regular tool to bring stakeholders together. And again, the bottom line is the community work goes beyond fact sheets and public meetings. And thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sharon. I think that this was a very nice presentation, and I want to congratulate you on your many awards. I do think your pre and your post intervention data is very, very impressive. So it's an interesting study. We have a lot of questions that have come in on the internet, but I also want to give the opportunity to the people on the phone to ask questions. So I'll remind you to place your phone on, or take your phone off of mute by pressing *6. And any questions on the phones?
I do have one.
Go ahead. Please state your name and where you're from.
Valerie George from University of Rochester. A quick comment is I really like that you mentioned that you watched what people were leaving with to kind of confirm the behavior change, because we've had issues with doing surveys and reported change is not always the same as actual behavior change, especially in some cultures and the way they respond to things. But one question I had was, is there any pattern that you saw in terms of demographics for people who didn't change?
Are you asking about the angler behavior or
yes.
the
for the consumption?
Okay. So for I just want to make a so for the community piece, because the follow up survey was done via phone, so there was not really the verification piece. But for the angler, there is this verification piece where you mentioned that we actually did a visual observation looking in the bucket. Actually, the outreach workers went through intensive fish identification training, so they were able to look at that. And then there were people who were still leaving the pier with white croakers. We didn't ask for why they were doing it because we were just doing the visual observation, writing it down. But we assume that they probably need the food source for their family. They're just, you know, with the economic situation. And we don't only just see it at Palos Verdes Shelf. We see it in the San Francisco Bay, too. Even there's intervention and outreach. Folks are still leaving the pier with contaminated fish.
Okay, so when you were doing the observations on the pier, you weren't also interviewing anglers?
No.
Okay.
We think it will just bias our results. So what we did is we did pre-intervention, the baseline survey first, and then we waited. So that was done in May, June 2008. Then we did the intervention in September and October 2008. Then we went back for the post-intervention just for the data recording in October and November.
Okay.
Yeah. Are there other calls on the line? I mean, other questions?
Yes. This is Christy Drew down at NIEHS as well, and we were having some questions about the selection of the croaker as the targeted fish of choice. Just we're assuming that, you know, there are other fish species that are out there that folks are fishing for, and so could you talk a little bit about why the croaker was chosen? And then I have a second piece, but maybe I'll let you
Okay. Great question. So we actually analyzed about 32 species in the Southern California, covering both from pelagic species to water column species and bottom feeders. And white croaker has the highest contamination level for DDT and PCBs because it's a bottom driller, and also it has very fatty tissue. So the DDT and PCB tend to stay in the fatty part of the fish. And moreover, it's the third mostly commonly caught fish species in the Southern California area based on the recreational fishing data that we have from the state. And a lot of ethnic fishermen, they just take whatever they can catch. So they're not really focusing on certain species like more of the well-off anglers are doing sometimes. And then white croaker is also available in a pretty long seasonality-wise. They're available for a long period of time throughout the year. They're very easy to catch. A lot of times they're a bycatch. But in addition, that we only see white croakers coming up in ethnic markets. You don't see it at Safeway or Raley's in these major supermarkets. People don't eat that fish. And that's why we focus on the most contaminated species, and that's why the state regulations are focusing on that particular species because of the abundance and also the contaminant level.
That's really interesting, and that helps a lot. One of the other questions that we were thinking about is sort of that just noting you had some pictures of the enforcement chain and looking at how the fish are arriving and how some of the enforcement is happening on the bay itself, and other folks are looking at the supermarket shelves. But we were wondering if there was other kind of opportunities for this fish to enter the food chain, either through processing into fish oil supplements or, you know, even sort of grinding into meal for fish food or actually somehow processing it for like fish cakes or something like that. And is there any evidence that you have about those types of ways that it could still be entering the food
chain? Yeah, we do have anecdotal information from the community members about white croakers entering mainly through fish paste and fish cake, as you mentioned. Right now, we're still working with
the California Department of Fish and Game because they're the enforcement folks, and they have sort of business, privileged business information where we're still trying to track to see where all the contaminated white croakers are going, because what we see from the landing data do not really match what we see at the market. The landing data shows there are not more white croakers being landed in the area than what we see in the consumer markets. So we are still trying to figure out this piece of puzzle, and that food processing is one of the targets that we still need to investigate fully.
Great, thank you so much.
Sharon, kind of along those lines of Christy's first question was, a question that came in online was, can you tell us the range of DDT concentrations in the fillet and the whole fish?
In the fillet and the whole fish. So it depends. So if you're looking at white croakers, it depends where you catch it. It has a wide range. I can provide more detailed information if that person is interested, but
we can do that online,
above FDA level.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions from the phone lines?
Yes, I am Huang Lin from DEP Pennsylvania, and you have the people go to the pier to check with the fish catch. Do your people encourage those anger fishermen do not put back the fish you don't want? Should pull the DDT contaminated fish out of the habitat, whole system in that bay. I think this is very important to get the food chance in that area with a high concentration, high contamination of DDP in sediment and in whole ecosystem there.
That's a good point. We didn't do that. We just asked them to do catch and release, but that's a good point. So you're saying that we should really, if they catch white croakers, contaminated white croakers, we should just tell them to dispose of it.
Yes. That is very important. And I am an Oriental. We eat the whole fish. Yeah. But should emphasize in your brochure or something, the DDT deposit in brain and this spinal cord and abdominal cavity fat is much, much higher than muscle.
Mm-hmm.
So should let those fishermen understand how come shouldn't eat whole fish and how come shouldn't put back into the system.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I also welcome you to visit our website, pbsfish.org. We have multilingual outreach materials and trying to explain that to the anglers and to our community. So thank you. Thanks for your input.
Thank you.
One of the questions that came in online, similar to a question that was asked of Anna, kind of about sustainability, and have you followed up at Belmont and Rainbow Piers to ensure there's continued change in this in those behaviors?
You know, I have not. So this was done on a sort of pilot scale that we were able to demonstrate that through the continuous outreach and education, we are able to change the behavior. What we are doing, what we've been doing, is doing those targeted behavior change at, I think, if I remember correctly, like 6 or 7 piers in the area. So those are the piers that receive outreach 4 days a week to ensure those behaviors are reinforced, the behavior change are reinforced. And we are tracking that data, and that data is being continuously uploaded to our GIS to our website with a GIS map.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the phone line? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Can you, Sharon?
Yeah, I can hear.
Okay.
Vaguely.
I'll try. Here, wait a minute. I'll try something else here.
I heard Chicago.
Okay. Is this?
Oh yeah, much better.
Okay, I have to call some. All right. This is Chuck Maurice in USEPA in Chicago. And I very much enjoyed your presentation again, Sharon. I think it was very instructive. I was focusing on slides 45 through 48, and I was trying to extract the meaning and interpretation out of it. And I was having a little bit of difficulty, so I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit. I was thinking that they were supposed to be interpreted in series, but maybe they're supposed to just be looked at individually. Because, as for instance, in the first time week zero, the overall consumption is of the community members, and I assume those are just the ones that were pulled, is like around 15%. But then yet there are more higher percentages of the community members that are eating, you know, the various parts, whether the fish are whole fillets or skinless or what have you. So I know that I'm not looking at it quite right. So I was wondering if you could explain it a little bit.
Yeah, I'll try. So for the 250 community members, we tested for immediate retention. So after 30 days, we were able to reach 150 of them and through the phone interview and ask them if they retained the information. So what you're seeing is a percentage of that 150 respondents for both the pre- and the post-outreach. So the first slide is looking at fish with skin, which is not the behavior we want to encourage. We want skinless fillet. So for the pre-outreach, we have about 60% of that 150 people said, I eat zero skin-on fillets. And then after the outreach, it increased. 80% of them said, I do not eat skin-on fillets. And then about, I guess, 18% of them pre-outreach said, I eat one time a week with, you know, skin-on fish fillet. So again, the fish fillet with skin is not a behavior that we want to encourage. So for the second slide on the skinless fish fillet, which is the consumption pattern that we want to promote pre- and post-outreach, we see more of them eating, at least for one time a week, eating more skinless fish fillet, which is good. And then 47 is on the whole fish consumption pattern, which we want to discourage. So, again, at zero, you see an increase of them eating zero whole fish. I know it's kind of confusing. So I don't know if you have any more questions about it.
So the horizontal axis with the time week, that's not number of weeks, time series. It's the number of whole fish
or
meals containing whole fish.
Right, a week they eat. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, it is confusing from a scientific standpoint for the series.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'll throw you at some more. I don't want to take up any more time. Thank you.
Other questions from the phone line? Well, going to the internet, a question here from Mercedes Hernandez Peltier at NC at Department of Health and Human Services. Are there fish advisory signs near the piers?
Yeah, very good question. Depending on where you are, overall signage is overall signage has not been well maintained in the area. Actually, now, because of updated fish advisory that was published by the state 2 years ago, this spring, actually, the next month, L.A. County Health, Department of Health, Public Health, which is the agency that has the responsibility for posting signage at the piers, will be putting the signs up. The EPA, under the Superfund program, is funding the signage design as well as the manufacturer of the signage for the local health agency to put that up. And then on the signage piece, we did a survey a couple years ago with the trustees. Overall, signage is not that helpful in terms of behavior change. About 50% of the anglers we interviewed said they've seen the sign, they are aware of advisory, but they're not really making any behavior change in terms of their fishing behavior based on the signage. What we find is that one-on-one, the peer-to-peer education seems to be more effective and obviously more resource-intensive, too, on the behavior change.
Okay. Kind of shifting veins on this, a question that came in from Margaret Byrne at the Fish and Wildlife. And is how did all of the trustee partners come to an agreement about the content that would be provided on the FCEC website? Was there a formal process to develop this content? Is one of the trustees partners taking the lead on this interactive web content?
The trustees have been a very close partner with EPA. The trustees consortium is led by NOAA as a federal agency and California Department of Fish and Game as a state agency. I think they're a total of 7 or 8 trustee agencies. So NOAA has been intimately involved in the content design of our website. And obviously EPA, you know, funded the whole effort, but they've been a close partner with us. And then they have their own newsletter, which we have linked to.
Okay, thank you. So before we have a lot of questions for both you, Sharon, and Anna. And so the last 10 to 15 minutes will go to questions for both of you or either of you, kind of open it up. But before we move into that section of the question and answers, I wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the links page and the online feedback form. On the links page, we've assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. And we typically place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations just as we heard them today. And also associated with the links page is an online feedback form. Like I mentioned before, we'd ask you that you consider filling out this form. We do look at your comments, and we continue to try to improve our webinar series. So the links to the additional resources page and the feedback form are both found on the last slide of the presentation. So now I'm going to return to the question and answer session for the last, I guess we have about 10 more minutes. And if you have a question, again, take your phone off mute, state your name and your organization, and then ask your question. So I'll open it up. Anyone online? I mean, on the phone lines?
Yes, for the Kentucky folks?
Yes.
I'm Braden Kay from School of Sustainability at Arizona State University. Sort of two questions. One is, given the sort of pre and post Einstein ladder evaluation that you did, would you recommend doing that, that EPA potentially adopt that as a general strategy of assessment for every major public engagement around Superfund sites? That's my first question.
I think that it's important that we find ways to measure how communities perceive our engagement efforts, whether that's Einstein ladder, whether that's specific questions and process evaluations. I think those are policy-level decisions that agencies need to work with communities to decide. What I, as a researcher, may or may not prefer, you know, I mean, that should really be influenced by what community members think. They might like that Einstein ladder. We found that folks did in this situation. But for a policy-wide implementation like that, I'd be interested to hear what the people on the ground, the people who are living with the risk, have to say about what their preferred metrics would be for that kind of evaluation. But I do think evaluating our engagement programs and where we are and where we should be is key to really having successful involvement with communities.
And sort of on top of that, given the possible implications of what happens when we have this open participatory decision-making or even just communication process, we've been finding that there's the potential to open up some wounds that are potentially hard to heal, especially given the fact that there's some parties that could have very heavy financial interests in some of these situations. How do we go through the process of letting communities know that we want to open up this process, but understanding that it has the potential to cause more controversy than good? What precautions do you think we can take, and how do you, what do you think are some key ways to move forward under those kinds of circumstances with some highly controversial Superfund sites?
That's a really good question, because on the ground you often find a lot of really old wounds, and as I was talking about, you have entrenched belief systems, you have stakeholder groups that perceive themselves as pitted against each other, even though they may actually have very similar perspectives, but they see themselves in different camps, so it's a real challenge. There are a couple of approaches to that that we use in this process. One is we tried to stay research problem focused. We were there to address future vision issues. We could not do a health assessment of the community. We could not diagnose cancer clusters. We were there to talk about the future vision of the site. Where health issues impacted those future uses, for example, concerns about contamination levels with certain industrial or light industrial uses, those kinds of things we tried to address in the public information section, where we just gave facts and figures, you know, for different kinds of exposures. And again, that's on the Paducah Vision website if you'd like to see how we went around about doing that interface. But secondly, what we did was we tried to keep people from co-opting meetings. And one way to do that was with the integration with structured public involvement. When we asked questions, when we had these discussions, we actually built a slide into the presentation that said, do we want to continue this discussion or go on to the next point? Because very often in public meetings, as I'm sure so many of you know, people stand up and they sort of co-opt the process. And they may spend 25, 30, 45 minutes, and you can't get on to the next person because they're sort of filibustering. But this was a democratic means. People had keypads. You could see the question would be, okay, we've had this discussion. This has been going on for 5 or 6 minutes. Are we ready to move on to the next topic? And then everyone in the room could vote democratically, yes, we want to move on to the next topic. And then the person who is filibustering sees that democratically that person is done. I mean, the room is ready to move on, and then you as a facilitator aren't shutting down conversation. It's the consensus of the group that then moves it on to the next topic, and in that way you can kind of avoid getting into rehashing the same old, same old. I mean, that's really what's important about these values exercises. Because when you identify that community values are similar across the board, it's just the weighting of those values that is different. You identify the commonalities from which people can start building relationships and consensus and having conversations when they realize they have more in common than not.
Excellent. Really impressed with your work. Thank you so much for your input.
Thank you so much. I hope things are well in Phoenix.
Thank you. We need it.
Are there additional questions from the phone lines for Sharon or for myself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was still on mute. This is Beth. Yes. Please go forward. So I have a question online for Sharon. Is the roadmap, slide 39, available for use as a model document for other agencies or individuals?
Yeah, definitely. Beth, how do I get it to the person? Or should I just send it to you?
Right. Well, no, we have the email address here.
Okay.
So,
great.
But we can, but I think that, are you doing, I think maybe the next step to that is, are you doing anything, have you published it in any way making this more available to a wider audience or wider user group?
The roadmap?
Yeah, the
document.
Strategic plan.
Yeah, so the roadmap document is actually on the pbsfish.org website. You probably have to navigate to, it's probably under the partner documents, but I can make sure that whoever has a question has that direct link to all to the PDF file.
Okay, we'll do that then. I have a few questions for Anna, kind of around the same topic that came in a little bit earlier, and so. It was about the composition of your focus groups, and Margaret Byrne asked, how did you, from Margaret Byrne from the Fish and Wildlife asked, how did you recruit? And another question was, how did you ensure representation from different stakeholders, and what was the age range, and was there any one age range that was predominant in your focus groups?
The focus group portion of the process was, again, a qualitative process, and we used snowball sampling as recruitment. So as we interviewed people in the early listening tour stage, we tried to encourage everyone to be involved, tell their friends and neighbors, and get them involved. When it came time to recruit for the focus group, one of the key elements was that pilot advisory group that I talked about. Those folks were sort of gatekeepers into their specific constituencies. So we were able to go to them and ask for assistance in recruiting from, say, the economic development community or from, for example, the water policy district presidents. We had, on average, we had about 9 or 10 folks at each focus group, which is sort of an optimal size. We had two focus groups that were quite small that really sort of turned into more interview-focused interchanges because you can't guarantee anonymity of the keypad exercises when you've just got two or three people in a room. So we wanted to be kind of careful about those things. We recruited by email, snowball sampling email, sending out to everyone we interviewed in the first stage, which again was 66 people. Our focus groups, our pilot test group sent out emails. One member of our pilot test group actually sent out a mailing to about 200 healthcare practitioners in the community. We worked with the Department of Energy and USEC to send a mailing to all of their employees, an internal mailing. And we worked with one of their subcontractors to get a mailing, a hard copy mailing out to all of the residents within the water policy district. So we really tried to cast a broad net. The statistical significance of the sample was not that important because it was a focus group discussion-driven conversation where we tried to make sure we had representativeness from the community within dividing the stakeholder groups like we did, by knowing that we needed to have perspectives from people who lived in the water policy, by knowing that we needed to have perspectives from people who use the wildlife management area. That was the key to making sure that we had a diversity of interests represented. As far as
did you have information on age ranges?
Yes, that is all on the PaducaVision.com website. And again, the age ranges for the focus groups varied depending on what the focus group was. Obviously, with the PGDP employees, you have a very specific 30-something, 40-something kind of range. But when you get into the public meetings at a later stage, which was not part of really what I discussed today, but that's one of our concerns with our low end and why we're still continuing to collect data from those meetings is because we have a demographic hole right in the middle. The people who attended those public meetings tended to be either 20-something or 60-something, 70-something. So the working age folks, people with families, people who have kids in soccer games at night, obviously were less likely to attend those meetings. So we're starting to try to target sample those groups through things like community organization meetings. We're going to meet with a Rotary Club. We're trying to get in to do some in-service with some teachers to help fill that demographic gap in the quantitative data, but that's not as important for the qualitative data. What was important for the qualitative data was making sure that we talked to all of the stakeholder groups, not necessarily a statistically significant N within a specific stakeholder group.
Okay, thank you. And just one last question about the stakeholder groups, kind of quickly as we're running out of time here. Were stakeholder group members anxious to participate at the outset? And if not, how did you get groups to participate?
Some were very, very eager to participate. If you look back at that scoring slide, and I'm sorry, I'm not looking at the presentation right now, but if you look back at the process scores, that's indicated in some of those. The Ballard County citizens were very excited to participate, and a number of the other groups were very excited to have a seat at the table. And have a seat at the table specifically related to their commitments and needs. So that was really important. Of course, some were not. The environmental and health group was unfortunately one of those groups that just we had a hard time with participation. We spoke with some individuals and some groups in the interview phase, but a lot of those folks, due to past experiences, had opted out of the process already. They had decided that this was going to be the same kind of process that they had been through so many times, and why sort of waste their time. We're working on addressing those issues, and that's a big question that this project has, is how do you engage people in these chronic risk situations who have checked out after 20 years of public meetings? And if anybody on this line has answers to that question or wants to sit around and talk about ideas about how we can do that, I would love to hear from you. Just send me an email after the call.
Okay. Thank you, Anna. We're really probably have run out of time, but I will open the phone line up for one last question for Anna or Sharon. Well, I guess that it is time to come to close here. I really appreciate both. I want to thank Anna and Sharon for their presentations. They were quite fine today. And if you posted a question on the website or on the internet, these questions, and they weren't answered online, and there are quite a few of them here that came in, these will be answered by Anna or Sharon, so you'll hear back from them via email. And if you are on the phone lines and have a question, use the contact information on the last slide to get in touch with them or to get in touch with us. So again, I'd like to thank our presenters, Dr. Anna Hoover and Ms. Sharon Lynn, for their time in preparing and for sharing their presentations with us today. And that concludes our call for today. I thank you for your participation, and I hope you'll join us on April 14th.